Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Thanks for your patience as we get started a little bit late. We had a few things on the floor today. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 345. Senator Thompson, thanks for your patience. If you'd like to bring anybody up with you you'd like, Troy can give us a summary as you get settled.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 345 exempts pedestrians on certain narrow residential roadways from offense of pedestrian with improper position upon or improperly proceeding along a highway, declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Vice Chairs in Committee. Senator Chuck Thompson, District 26, Hood River County, Multnomah County, and Clackamas County. And I'm here today with the City of Portland on a great idea for a lot of Portland city streets. Senate Bill 345 comes to you with a unanimous do-pass recommendation from the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and a near-unanimous 27-to-1 vote in the full Senate. This bill will give local communities an option for more cost-effectively improving unpaved residential roads. The City of Portland has identified shared narrow residential roadways as a potential option for improving unpaved residential roads, including some in my district. Narrow residential roadways are already defined in statute and subject to a 15-mile-an-hour speed limit. Senate Bill 345 proposes to amend the Oregon Vehicle Code to allow pedestrians on a narrow residential roadway if the local jurisdiction posts signage indicating the presence of pedestrians in the roadway and the pedestrian does not create a traffic hazard. Senate Bill 345 will allow local governments to use shared, paved, narrow residential roadways as a way to provide safe, cost-effective improvements to gravel and dirt streets. I urge your support for Senate Bill 345. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not sure what the schedule's like in the Senate, but let's see if there are questions for you so you can excuse yourself if you
We're not too busy over there. I'm going to hang around.
Okay. Very good. Well, unless you're for the rest
you
of the panel
are
first.
You guys are really busy. I feel sorry for you guys, but
Your turn will come, I'm sure.
Okay.
Let's hear from the rest of the panel then, and we'll see if there are questions.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeis, the State Government Relations Manager with the City of Portland. With me here today is Christine Leon of the Portland Bureau of Transportation. We appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 345, dealing with shared narrow residential roadways. As Ms. Leon will discuss in more detail, this bill will enable common sense, cost-effective neighborhood street design options for not just the City of Portland, but all Oregon communities by making a modest amendment to the State Vehicle Code. We hope the committee will support Senate Bill 345, and we'll be happy to address any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Leon.
So good afternoon, Chair Reed and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Christine Leon, and I'm the development manager and principal engineer for the City of Portland Bureau of Transportation. So the City of Portland requests your support in for Senate Bill 345. And as mentioned, this will provide the local jurisdictions the option, if they choose to post the appropriate signs, to allow pedestrians to travel on designated low-speed, narrow residential roadways, sharing the roadways with vehicles. It enables a context-based approach to implement street improvements that are more cost-effective for residents and taxpayers. So within the City of Portland, there's 45 miles of gravel streets in residential areas, on residential streets. The cost of upgrading these streets to our traditional standard is out of reach for most people. And the City of Portland recently adopted two new standards. The shared street is one of those that can be applied on a context-based approach where it makes sense. This will help address the problem of having gravel streets and dirt and gravel streets in the City of Portland, which are impediment to mobility, to then be improved. So again, what the standard calls for, and you can see on the first page, is a narrow paved section that serves as a shared space for pedestrians, bicycles, wheelchair users. So it's not a right solution for every street, As I mentioned, it's a context-based approach that allows the flexibility to design and build what's appropriate in our residential neighborhoods. So as Senator Thompson mentioned, ORS defines what a narrow residential roadway is. It's a two-way road not wider than 18 feet in a residential district. And in recognition of the unique characteristics and uses of these streets, the vehicle code in ORS 811 specifies a 15-mile-an-hour regulatory speed limit for these. So the Oregon Vehicle Code provisions currently do not differentiate between a low-speed, narrow residential roadway and a wider, faster-speed roadway. Included within my testimony are some photos. The one on the first page that we're looking at is an example of a street that is not a narrow residential roadway. The photos on the next page are good examples of shared residential narrow low-speed roadways where if this bill were passed, pedestrians would be able to be in the roadway, not confined to the outer left edge, which is what currently Oregon Vehicle Code requires. So this allows, as I mentioned, the city of Portland to improve streets that are currently dirt and gravel. This would allow pedestrians and wheelchair users to travel on a low-speed, narrow residential roadway, so long as we post the signs indicating the possible presence of pedestrians and the pedestrian does not create a traffic hazard. And again, this gives the local jurisdiction the voluntary option of designating a narrow residential roadway segment for shared use by pedestrians and vehicles. So in doing so, we remove the traditional barriers of the curb, the sidewalk, the curb ramps, the driveway approaches. Just two more points to be made. Gravel streets, they are a real barrier to mobility. There's issues with ADA access. Our TriMet lift operators have a very difficult problem getting people out of their homes onto buses on gravel streets. The fire bureau, bicyclists, motorists have difficulty, in addition to the homeowners that are responsible, at least in the city of Portland, for maintaining such roads. Regarding the costs, the shared street option is 75% cheaper than the traditional improvement that we've estimated. So we hopefully that we respectfully urge you to support this bill, Senate Bill 345, which will provide local governments the option allowing pedestrians to travel on low-speed, narrow residential roadways and enable more cost-effective street design standards. So I thank you for your consideration, and we'll be here for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. I would note for the committee's benefit, there were three letters, I think, that came as part of your testimony from different neighborhood associations commenting on the bill as well. Your questions? Representative Doherty.
Thank you for the information. Since I represent Far Southwest, which also has no sidewalks, and I looked at what you had for Southwest 45th. Now, you're not going to designate Capitol Highway. I mean, we'd love to have it, because Capitol Highway, there's no shoulders, when I looked at the picture here, there's really very little walkway. So is Capitol Highway going to be considered this, or are you guys going to work on it?
So, Chair Reed, Representative Doherty, that is a street where we will not be applying the residential roadway narrow street standards of a shared roadway. It's inappropriate. It's high speed. It's higher than what we deem safe thresholds for traffic volume. Pedestrians need to be separated from motorists in that case. We'd love to have sidewalks.
And Representative Doherty, you might notice on the second paragraph of Leanne's testimony, it notes that ORS 801-368 defines narrow residential roadway is a two-way road not wider than 18 feet located in a residential district.
Yes. Well, those people that go on Capitol Highway were always still trying from Capitol, from Barber down to Multnomah. So.
Some other solutions there.
And we will keep trying, so.
Other questions? Representative Bent, sorry.
Thank you. So the obvious trade-off is safety of the pedestrian versus on the one hand and having a nice paved road on the other. And so in situations where we face this with folks on each side of the road being incapable of affording the limited improvement district cost, the road stays gravel because it almost tends to slow people down. It's usually in horrible shape, just like the picture here. So when we've discussed this several times, the issue has been that trade-off. And so what I've heard in these discussions is that this bill reflects an appropriate balance between the fact that you're going to have people out wandering up and down the street in the middle of it in wheelchairs and skateboards and otherwise with equal right to be there as a car, but going 15 miles an hour. So that's what we're doing, isn't it? We're trying to balance those two against each other.
So, Chair Reed, Representative Bench, it's not a trade-off. By allowing the local jurisdiction the choice to apply this where they deem it's appropriate, then they have the ability to look at the context of the environment to see where it should be built. For example, the streets need to be narrow, low speed, good visibility. There is a barrier to mobility when the street is gravel. The context to which these will be constructed also includes the signage that alerts motorists for the possible presence of pedestrians.
Well, the issue is, I hope I have this right, we currently, the assumption is we have a gravel road. We pave it. We don't put in a sidewalk. We don't put in gutters. We just get it paved. So now, where before we had a gravel road, we now have a paved one. But the pedestrian under this also is given the right to be in the middle of it, just like cars have that right. That's the change, I think, isn't it? Currently, they're not allowed to stumble down the middle of the gravel road. They're supposed to stay over on the side. Is that correct?
So, Chair Reed and Representative Benz, the current Oregon vehicle law requires pedestrians, when there's not a usable shoulder or a sidewalk, to travel down the left side of the road as near to the edge as possible. And Oregon Vehicle Code also recognizes a gravel road as a roadway. So regardless of it's paved or gravel, the pedestrian is still, under current law, confined to the outer edge, and it doesn't make any distinction between, again, a Southwest 45th Avenue, except in the narrowness definition, higher speed facility, or a narrow residential roadway with respect to the placement of a pedestrian. What this bill would do is allow the pedestrian to be within the roadway as long as the local jurisdiction has found that it's a safe place for that pedestrian to be and signs are posted.
Okay, I think you just said yes to my question. Right now, they're not allowed in the middle of the road when it's gravel. In the future, they would be. And so the question is, will the local jurisdiction appropriately exercise its judgment in allowing these streets to be paved without sidewalks? And that's going to be the issue. That's going to be the balancing that I'm talking about. And by passing this legislation, we would be giving jurisdictions that power, that authority. And the other thing, of course, that happens is you default to the least expensive device. Mm-hmm. And so I anticipate that we would see many of these without sidewalks.
Can I follow up on that? See if I'm understanding your question correctly, that you're asking if in moving from the gravel to the paved, this would reduce the incentive to include sidewalks and gutters and all the other appropriate things?
Of course.
Okay. So, Chair Reed and Representative Bench, right now we're finding that the ability to improve residential streets to the standard that includes sidewalks and curbs and stormwater facilities is beyond the reach of most people, and so they're not getting improved. This solution allows for a cost-effective measure to make improvements to roadways so that they are still safe and so that they provide mobility options for people. So in the city of Portland, we are defining certain criteria that we will apply to when this is a context-sensitive approach that we're going to allow. By including in the bill the enabling option for the local jurisdiction to post the sign, that then allows each jurisdiction to determine when the pedestrian has these rights under this bill, or when the rights under the current vehicle code apply. So if it's not signed, and it doesn't meet the definition of a narrow residential roadway, the pedestrian is still required to follow the statute that currently exists.
Right, and we're saying the same thing. The point is, this legislation would allow jurisdictions, upon their determination that in their opinion it's safe, then the pedestrian could wander down the center of the road, now paved. And the hope would be that in most cases we would someday have money sufficient to meet the really high and expensive standards now apply. Because I've been through this and had to go to elderly fixed income neighbors and say, surprise, we're going to do an LID on you, and a majority has voted, and boy, are you going to get a big, huge bill. And people are very unhappy about that. So I understand exactly why we're doing this, but I want it really clear what the trade-off is, and the trade-off is safety. So it's that simple, because people would be safer on a sidewalk, and we're basically saying, no, people don't have the money. We're going to pave the road and hope whoever we give this power to will exercise it appropriately. But nonetheless, we will now have people in streets paved where in the past they've been on gravel. Because I don't think the choice is the real fancy things we've been doing, because we can't afford it. The whole thing has grown up to a point where it's ridiculous. So I'm not saying a dispute with what you're trying to do. I'm just wanting to make it clear what the trade-off is.
So that prompts another question for me. In the design, in the scenario where a jurisdiction decides this is appropriate and goes forward with it, is the eventual addition of sidewalks and so on still part of your consideration? And okay, you can pave or improve, and we're going to enact this new standard,
but we're not going to do that in a way that prevents the subsequent addition of those additional amenities?
Right. Chair Reed, this is a means to get an improvement that can be built to the pavement standard that the city will then maintain, which again takes a burden off of the property owners, because if it's not built to the city standard, then the property owners still maintain the streets, but does not preclude a future build out to a more traditional standard.
Representative Leavitt?
So, I'm sorry, I got confused in going through all this. So, what this law, which works with, quote, the narrow streets, so those 18 feet or under, changes. So the law currently that requires people to walk on the left-hand side out of the traffic, but this law will supersede or changes that. So on these streets, I'm going to go back to what Representative Benson, I'm just trying to understand. So on these streets, people aren't required to walk on the left-hand side out of traffic?
So, Chair Reed, Representative Lively, I got to get that down.
Right. We're not that formal here.
The posting by the local jurisdiction of the signage, if this bill were passed, would enable a pedestrian to be in the roadway beyond the outer left side of the road. The local jurisdiction, and I can speak for what we're doing in the city of Portland, is applying this standard where we deem it is safe for a pedestrian. We are not going to compromise the safety of pedestrians by enabling them to be in a shared roadway.
Well, I guess I'm just not getting, though, why it would be deemed under the standard, and you've paved the street in it, why it still wouldn't be the safest, since people are accustomed to the rule being that you walk on the left-hand side and as far as the right. So I'm getting confused about how it's safer. I mean, the street's paved, it's narrow, there's very little land. So I'm not sure how that makes it safer. There's still cars on that street, and most people driving a car would expect people to be on the left-hand side coming at them. So I guess I'm still confused about how, under any circumstances, you could define that that would be safer than people still staying on the left-hand side so the cars can expect where they would be.
And Representative Lively, you're asking a version of a question that I had in mind, too, so maybe I could just add on to it a little bit, which is sort of education. If this goes forward, how do you intend to help both drivers and pedestrians understand how the new structure would work?
Okay, so Chair Reed and Representative Lively, we intend to apply this again in the context of where it makes sense. The narrow residential roadways exist throughout the state. There's certainly more than 45 miles within the city of Portland. People use the streets today, and they are not confined to the left side of the roadway. We found not necessarily enforced throughout the state, probably throughout the country that way, but people use these roadways outside of the confines of the outer left edge because they feel it is safe to do so. So by adopting a standard in the city of Portland, we want to make sure that the streets are designed and used within the law. So what we plan to do to educate people is we have been developing brochures and websites, and every case that comes into the city of Portland as a request to do a street improvement, either if you're a developer or a non-developing resident, we have a number of criteria that we are applying to whether or not the standard is appropriate. There's also traffic calming measures that we've included into the base design, which can be any number of things. Because we want to assure that it is safe, and that means that it has to be low speed, low volume, good visibility. So hopefully that addresses some of the question. I mean, I think I get to understand what exactly you're asking. Why can't people just stay on the left side
right,
of the roadway?
That's what I'm asking, but yeah, thank you.
People don't stay on the left side of the roadway. Traffic engineering is like a human nature study. Yeah.
Follow up.
And so I understand that, I guess. To me, that's an enforcement issue versus the fact that we make it even, you know. I live in an area where we have some unpaved streets and they're fairly narrow, but the thing that makes it safe under any circumstance today is I know they're going to be on the left-hand side and the people that walk there on the left-hand side. And so I guess that's what concerns me about this is the fact that, and it's not a designated narrow roadway, it's a county road, and that's just what the county road is, but that's the only place for them to walk. And so that's what concerns me about going back to the safety thing again. If it's an enforcement issue, then we ought to be enforcing the current law. And I'm not saying that's what police have a lot of time to be doing. But those are two different issues. And so if it's the reason we're doing this is because we're not enforcing it, to me that's the wrong reason to do it versus some other reason. I guess that's, you know, I'm not trying to argue with you what you're doing. But.
So Chair Reed, Representative Lively, the basic reason we're doing this is to provide affordable options for people to get street improvements. Also, the current right-of-way laws that exist within Oregon statute still apply. This does not give the pedestrian a right-of-way over a vehicle. So that may help answer the question that I should have maybe stated earlier.
Thank you.
Representative Gorsuch, then Representative McEwen.
Out where I live in Troutdale, so east of Portland. We have an area that had been pastures, and we had an old country road called Hensley, and Hensley was just a two-lane, 55-mile-an-hour thing with dirt shoulders. They then built a very large complex, and part of the requirement of building that complex was to make Hensley, like, you know, with sidewalks and paved and everything. But there's a section further north that didn't get that treatment. It wasn't part of that redevelopment. And so what the city did is they didn't change the two-lane road, they didn't change the shoulders. What they did do, though, is add a sidewalk. And the sidewalk doesn't, it's not curbs and all of that, it's just a sidewalk piece. And I'm just wondering if it's possible to do a design like this and have one side of the road have a sidewalk that's kind of up in the gravel. So that you take care of some of the concerns in terms of pedestrians, because it seems to work really well. So I don't know if that's feasible, if this is already a set plan or what.
So Chair Reed, Representative Gorsuch, mention that the city has recently adopted two standards.
Okay.
The shared is where there's no sidewalk. We also have the separated, which is essentially what you're saying, is where the context requires a separation of pedestrians, and it's still maybe a narrow residential roadway, but we deem as a local jurisdiction that there needs to be a sidewalk, then we will require the separated, again, which is the pavement with the separated sidewalk,
so,
or the traditional.
So, and, but you don't have, yeah, follow up, please. but you don't have to do the curb and all of that, right? You can just do the sidewalk.
Chair Reed, Representative. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Yes. That's what I was thinking
with
of.
With the
okay.
curb and the traditional vertical separation, we're calling that the traditional standard.
Okay.
Yeah, and the cross-section that you're referring to is essentially horizontal separation between the roadway and the sidewalk, but not necessarily the curb.
Right.
The curb introduces additional costs with respect to stormwater runoff and
right.
ADA ramps and driveway ramps. Right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McHugh.
This is fascinating. Are people being cited for this on a regular basis?
I'm sorry, I think.
Are people being cited for not complying on a regular basis?
Chair Reed, Representative McHugh, I'm not sure. I am looking to Mr. Eisenbeiss, what we're currently getting within the City of Portland as far as citations. I can personally say that there is a number of people that I know that do walk in the center of the roadway that are not cited. So
okay. I can respond to that.
No.
Okay. When I work for Portland Police, I don't know of anybody that ever cited anyone for that at all.
Thank you.
And we have lots of streets like that.
And you know, but pardon me, some of these questions, but is this a City of Portland issue or is this a statewide issue?
Well, Representative McHugh, we're going to hear from the League of Cities next, too.
Okay, that would be helpful for me. I would appreciate that. Traffic calming, is that speed bumps? What is traffic calming?
So, Representative McHugh, traffic calming can include speed bumps.
Mm-hmm.
It can also include chicanes, which is a hard right within the roadway, still providing visibility,
mm-hmm.
Traffic diverters. So there's a number of technical elements that you can apply to a street to make sure that the volumes and the speeds still stay slow.
Thank you.
Any questions? I don't see any. I do have one for you, Senator. Any idea why Senator Whitsitt voted no?
Just trying to keep his vote count up. Did I strike that from the record?
No, already out there.
It's too late.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Craig Honeyman and Steph Routh on the list. Thanks, please. That was good. A parting shot we didn't get to hear. Who's first?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Craig Honeyman with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 345. While introduced on behalf of the City of Portland, the League feels that it will provide a helpful tool for cities throughout the state, allowing the creation of some cost-effective design standards for low-speed, low-volume streets that provide an opportunity for shared usage, pedestrians, bicycles, autos. The bill only applies if signage is posted to enhance awareness that the pedestrian traffic is possible, thus providing for increased safety. The bill is not proscriptive, but rather provides cities with this local option. To the comment about other cities, it is my belief that although drafted either by or for the City of Portland, that other cities can, that the same situation will apply in other cities throughout the state. that it's a cost-effective solution to the more expensive, more comprehensive design standards. We heard from Senator Thompson that there's an opportunity for at least a city that he represents to participate. I can tell you in the past, I've had discussions with the city of Ashland on a similar but not identical situation. The difference being, I don't think there's, as I recall, this goes back about 3 years ago, their situation may not have been a residential roadway as defined in statute. And to the issue of enforcement that somebody raised, I haven't done a complete analysis of enforcement, you know, local police enforcement policies, but I think it's fair to say that the existing statute that these are seeking to amend are probably not enforced comprehensively today. So with that, I'll take any questions. Appreciate the opportunity to lend my support and the league's support to Senate Bill 345.
Thank you. Ms. Roth, let's hear from you, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Great. Chair Reed, members of the committee, hello. My name is Stephanie Routh. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Walks. We're a nonprofit organization committed to improving walking conditions and making walking safe, convenient, and attractive for everyone. And we just want to lend our fervent support for Senate Bill 345. Feel that one element that we like is the element of wayfinding or signage, that would provide a safety message for all road users on their residential ways that, as I think has been discussed before, already use those roadways in that capacity. And with that, I'll just end with a confession that when I was very young, my Grammy and I used to go on walks regularly when I visited her in Wheeler, and we would not be as far to the left as practical single file. I believe the statute of limitations has gone since then, so I'm not in trouble. Yeah. Well, we'll see. Well, and there's a part two of the confession, but we walked side by side, and she held my hand, and I have done the same. And the statute of limitations has not gone on that. I have done it so recently with my niece in Beaverton, so sue me. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 345. Anyone else want to be heard? Don't see anyone.
So Mr. Chair. Representative Betts, if I just maybe, while we're still talking about this, sure. The challenge in our small towns has been trying to find the money necessary to meet all of the many, 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 many requirements that go with these streets now and the wonderful design of them. But we just don't have the money. And so it's almost as though the price has pushed us into this very odd position of taking a very modest degree of risk. But folks simply can't afford it. And so that means we're kind of locked into a future of dirt, gravel roads, which are bad every way you measure them, or this future, which, by the way, I support. But I believe if we were looking for someone to blame, it's probably ourselves for raising those requirements so high.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the...
Oh, I just an additional comment. You could probably define traffic calming as allowing residents and skateboarders to go down the middle of the street.
Well, they do that in downtown Portland. Yeah,
I suppose it depends on your perspective. That might be maddening to some people.
Yes.
But I hear what you're saying. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 345. And any reason not to go right down the list? Sure. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 178. Invite Mr. Swerker up. So you want to give us a summary, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 178 authorizes Department of Aviation to impose civil penalties for violations of aviation laws, rules, and orders, declares emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Mr. Director.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Swecker. I'm the director of the Department of Aviation, and I'm bringing before you Senate Bill 178, which is a very straightforward bill that would give civil penalty authority to the Department under the Administrative Procedures Act, similar to what a lot of other state agencies have. I've submitted written testimony, and I won't go through it, but I will point out that there are three specific examples that happened while I've been at the agency that are direct reflections of something that I think would help to be alleviated by having a bill like Senate Bill 178, Civil Penalty Authority, primarily as a deterrent. I make three quick points. The points are, we do view it as a deterrent. The Administrative Procedures Act is a very tough process to go through. It wouldn't be routinely used. The second thing is that Oregon Pilots Association has approved this. I went before their board and they voted to support this bill. And the last thing is we'll be willing to, or we are going to do, rulemaking if this bill passes, to narrowly define the scope and make the fines reasonable and proportional for the offenses under the chapter. And subject to any questions, that would complete my testimony.
Questions? So same question I asked Senator Thompson. I didn't look up who the two no votes were in the Senate, but any idea why they voted no?
I don't know. Senator Bart Sugar was one. And Senator Witt said I sat down with him afterwards. He thought it might have been a little bit too over the top, some of the things that are in the chapter. And that's why I think we can look at rulemaking to address his concerns.
Okay.
Make it proportional.
Thank you. Representative Benz?
Has there been a need for these penalties in the past?
I cite the safety examples there. We know there are folks out there who know we don't have any teeth of enforcement or deterrent capability. And the three examples that I'm talking about are examples of that. So in the one case at Aurora, we have a rule that prohibits people from landing on the infield, and we know that they do it routinely, even though it's against our rules. It's kind of a safety issue. We had people actually working in the infield, and they come in there and they land with the big balloon tires.
Well, maybe not kind of a safety issue, but really a safety issue?
Yes, a safety issue. More than kind of a safety issue. Chair Reed.
Oh, yes, my brother was landing at the Ontario airport on his some sort of a plane, and he was very just learning, and he bounced into the infield and then back onto the strip. And then would he get fined for that or just hopefully take his license taken away? Which
Representative Betts, that would be not something we do. What we're looking for is the flagrant disregard for the rules and regulations. That would be something where somebody is just, you know, not as proficient as they could be.
Thank you.
No one else? You're the only one who signed up to testify. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Anyone else want to be heard on Senate Bill 178? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 178 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 408. Mr. Director, you want to get us started and bring anyone you'd like with you? Sorry, I'll give us a summary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the...
I'm not signed up, sir.
Very good. Well, if you want to start us, that's fine. Go ahead, Troy, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 408A specifies that existing approach roads are presumed to have written permission from the Oregon Department of Transportation in certain circumstances, specifies that written permission qualifies as approach permit, makes property owner with approach permit responsible for costs and performance of maintaining approach road, requires facility plans to include methodology for balancing economic development objectives of abutting properties with transportation safety and access management objectives of state highways, outlines requirements for facility plans, requires development of access management strategies for highway improvement projects included in the statewide transportation improvement program.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Okay, thank you. For the record, I'm Representative Margaret Doherty from House District 35, Tigard in Southwest Portland. And actually, today I'm sitting in for Senator Betsy Johnson. She is incapacitated, but did want... I'm going over some of the things that she said on the Senate floor when this bill passed. But... I'm extremely pleased to be here to bring this bill to you today. It's a result of the work of the Access Management Task Force. ODOT has been managing access to our state highways for a little over a decade. And while no one disputes the primary goal of access management, that is to allow businesses and individuals access to our state highways while at the same time maintaining safety and mobility. The problem we face was that of a process that was broken. So Senate Bill 408 is the third in a series of bills designed to address this very significant problem. So I'm going to go over and talk a little bit about the background of the bill, or actually Senator Johnson is, and then Mr. Garrett and Mr. Bryant will talk about the bill specifically. The first bill, and I do sit on the Access Management Task Force, so that's why I'm here. The first bill, Senate Bill 1024, was passed during the 2010 legislative session, and this bill established objective standards for the change of use, allowing property owners to remodel or expand their facilities without fear of losing their driveways. The second bill, Senate Bill 264, was more extensive and was passed in 2011. This bill was approved by 30-0 in the Senate side and 59-1 on the House. This bill established objective standards for obtaining a permit to install a driveway, established reasonable dispute resolution and appeals processes, changed the burden of proof to establish a legitimate safety concern from the owner of the property to ODOT, and repealed the idea that access from a local street was sufficient to close or deny a driveway connecting to a state highway. The bill also included a new statement of legislative intent that requires the department to balance economic development objectives with the highway safety and mobility. Additionally, Senate Bill 264 set up an 11-member task force, the Access Management Oversight Task Force, to monitor this program. The Access Management Oversight Task Force will remain in place until January 2nd of 2016. We've met probably maybe half a dozen times from the last session to this session to go through and deal with some of the issues that were still outstanding. And some of the issues that were outstanding, the result of this is the Senate bill you're hearing today. The task force will closely monitor and implement the implementation of Senate Bill 408 and will draft additional access management legislation if it becomes necessary. The bill that was brought to you is, I think, actually work of not only some land use people and ODOT and stakeholders and the trucking industry and everybody else to go through and try to design a program that makes sure that people have access to driveways but also have safety on the roads.
Thank you. Who's next?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Department of Transportation. Appreciate this chance. Brought with me Bob Bryant. Bob is the ODOT Central Oregon Region Manager, but I have detailed him to the access management efforts over the last several years, and he's been at the tip of the spear, so to speak, in working the mechanics behind the pieces of legislation that we have moved and hope to move specific to the access management discipline. So, as Representative Doherty indicated that Senate Bill 408, the A engrossed version, continues our conversation related to the access management permitting disciplines here. You may recall we were before this committee in 2010 and 11 and were charged to develop legislation to codify, clarify, and bring consistency in how the agency issues permits for driveways onto state highways. So along with the stakeholders that the good representative identified, the agency has accomplished this work, and in doing so has made a significant shift in the way we approach the issuance of access permits. We have moved from an agency that in the past has focused primarily, if not solely, on safety and operations of the roadway when issuing a permit, to an agency that has established rules, protocols, practices which balance the safety and operations with the importance of facilitating economic development opportunities across this great state. This is indeed a paradigm shift. This allows us to accept prudent risk based on objective standards, and this creates an opportunity for ODOT, for local governments, for developments to engage the access management issues across the state with eyes wide open. So that said, the access management issues have been identified, as the good representative said, with the work of this oversight task force that was established in 2011 by Senate Bill 264. I'd be remiss if I didn't note the leadership, the co-chair, not only Senator Betsy Johnson, but also Polk County Commissioner Craig Pope. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank them for their leadership, for their focus, and for their commitment to seeking a balance in this conversation. We had, as was mentioned, over a handful of meetings that always, we're extremely robust and focused in trying to find the sweet spot here as we balance all these critical needs specific to access management conversations. In the end, the task force identified three priority areas to continue to work on as part of their work plan, those being existing unpermitted accesses, access management for highway planning activities, so all the activities, whether it's the planning discipline associated with an interchange area management plan or a corridor plan, a refinement plan, or just access management plans in general, and then the third and final priority being access management in the context of construction or project delivery. So Senate Bill 408A engrossed has been drafted as the legislative vehicle to address these priorities. It moved out of the Senate on a 30-0 vote. And what I'd like to do now, Mr. Chair, is turn to Mr. Bryant, who can walk through the mechanics that underpin what 408A does.
Thank you, Director. Chairman Reed and members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Bob Bryant, the region manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation for our ODOT Region 4, which is Central Oregon, here to speak on behalf of the department regarding Senate Bill 408. And first of all, I would like to also thank the hard work of Representative Doherty and her leadership and contribution to this important work. It's been a long road, and certainly appreciate everyone's contribution, Representative Doherty's. To note. To the three remaining items that the task force was interested in addressing on access management, as Director Garrett pointed out, the first being unpermitted approaches, general, the second being highway planning projects, and the third being highway construction or STIP programmed projects. Earlier legislation that was passed by the 2011 legislative session addressed unpermitted connections, unpermitted driveways to the highway, only in certain conditions. But it left out a large population of driveways, unpermitted driveways, from having the opportunity to use a less rigorous process for ODOT and that landowner to work together on getting their unpermitted driveway permitted. And so one of the things that our stakeholders wanted to do was to address that that larger population that got excluded from the earlier legislation so that all landowners with driveways that were unpermitted would have access to a less rigorous process for working with the department in getting their driveway permitted. What that led to was the legislation, Senate Bill 408, that presumes that those driveways existing prior to the year 2000, when we first implemented the prior version of our administrative rules around access management, for those driveways that have been in existence for a very long time, to presume that they have been built with ODOT's written permission. That enables the department, our agency, to work with the landowner to manage their driveway as if it has a written permit, and doesn't require at that to do that, to be able to have to go back and do all the research to see if it was grandfathered, when it was built, and so on and so forth. We're able to manage it as if it has a permit, and that has a benefit both to the landowner and to the agency. Certainly, as if there are safety or operational issues, we still have the ability under current legislation, current statute, to be able to work with that landowner up to and including closing driveways if they prove to be of such an issue from a safety aspect or operational aspect if that became required. But with the passage of this legislation, it would enable us, for those that don't create a problem, a safety issue or operational problem on the highway, it enables us to manage that driveway, those driveways, in conjunction with the landowner as if it was permitted. And on the second and third count there, with facility plans and with highway projects, we didn't have any specific language, administrative rules, that required us to engage landowners in the process that affected driveways, either as part of a planning project or construction project. So this legislation would direct the department to engage property owners owners early in the process of developing the methodology that will be used or could be used at some later date that could affect those property owners' driveways. So it establishes a process by which those landowners would engage earlier in with ODOT on developing that methodology under a planning project so that they're aware of what the potential might be in the future if and when those plans become implemented. And then likewise on highway construction projects, oftentimes today we haven't gone out in advance to involve landowners on issues pertaining to highway projects that could affect their driveway until we're ready to, until the decision's already been made on how their driveway is to be treated as part of that project, which is quite a ways down the road as far as our project goes. And so this process would, again, direct the department to engage those landowners earlier in that project development process to let them know what the strategy is for how we're going to manage access on that section of highway that's part of the programmed project and how that access management strategy might affect their individual driveway. And then both between the planning projects and projects that are programmed for construction, it also enables those landowners to have the ability to appeal a strategy or a methodology that could eventually affect their driveway if they're not in agreement with what that impact might be. So it it utilizes language that was established in earlier legislation to tap into the dispute review board that was created under Senate Bill 408 in the 2011 session to engage in issues with the department on whether we've adequately met that balance that the director talked about between meeting the safety and operational needs of the highway with the importance of the land use development opportunities that might occur on those abutting properties. So we've added that dispute review process for that landowner earlier in the process to again review whether and how well we've made that balance, made decisions that adequately balance traffic safety and operations with the importance of land use development and economic development opportunities on those abutting properties. So with that, I'm hopeful that this will conclude the work on access management for a while. But as Representative Doherty mentioned, we still have the Legislative Oversight Task Force available to us as we put these changes into place and can come back and review if there are ongoing issues that we need to manage as we implement these changes. Certainly we'll have the opportunity to bring folks back to the table, I think, and address what those might be. With that, be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bright. Is a while defined in the bill somewhere?
It's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer that. No problem. Any questions for these gentlemen? I don't see any. Representative Benz?
We can't.
Yeah, we can't let them
all,
do that.
All, like, this, you know? All this work.
I know. go to it.
It's shorter than it used to be when I saw this 6 years ago or whenever I first started seeing this. So I think that's progress. I guess I'm worried about some of the dates and how they are justified. The April 1st, 2000 date, you made reference to the fact that that was when this process started. So that's, but that seems a little, was there some sort of notice given or is there more substance to why that date?
Yes, Chair Reed and Representative Bentz, I think there is some significance to April 2000 in that that's when the current administrative rule or the earlier version of ODOT's administrative rules pertaining to access management went into effect. Prior to that, we had the legislation that required ODOT to regulate and administer and seek permits for access across the public right-of-way to a state highway, but we didn't have defined rules that enabled us to do that in a very consistent way. And so there was a significant effort done in the late 1990s that resulted in administrative rules that went into effect in 2000 that we began to administer process for managing access and permitting of access to the state highway in a much more consistent fashion. And so the idea is that if anything was done prior to that, it would have been done before those rules were in place and had the, and at the risk of you know, having been done in a less consistent fashion across the state. After those rules became in place, we had the mechanism for administering and managing our process for working with those abutting property owners to permit access across the right-of-way and to the state highway in a much more consistent way. And so, so that date is fairly significant as to, you know, whether that access came to be after we started applying the rules in April of 2000 or whether it was in place prior to that.
And my questions are primarily just to get something on the record so when someone challenges some of this, we have your answers to back in the history of this. So on line 21, it says the approach road was built or rebuilt with the department's knowledge. So what is knowledge? The fact that a ODOT truck was driving up and down the road every winter and happened to glance out the window, is that knowledge?
Well, it could be if it was recent enough that we can document that visual knowledge. Again, Chairman Reed and Representative Bentz, but the more traditional basis for ascertaining whether or not a driveway was built with ODOT's knowledge is written documentation, and the most common form is our contract plans. If it was built by ODOT as part of a project, then it's presumed, well, more than presumed to have been built with ODOT's knowledge because we included it as part of our project. So that's clearly an example of the documentation that would support the presumption that it was built with ODOT's knowledge. But there are other forms of documentation that could apply also, and that could be a letter to the file where a district manager, an ODOT district manager, supported or authorized the construction of a driveway, but never went so far with his staff to do the paperwork to get it permitted. And so there may be other forms of documentation that would indicate that it was built with ODOT's permission.
Most of my ranch clients and farms clients out across District 60 in the past, when they're putting in a road or something, simply pushed put a culvert in the borrow pit, push some dirt over it, and presto, they had access. And pretty informal. More recently, I've had folks contact our office and say that they'd encountered challenges when they tried to do that recently. I'm going to say within the last 10 years, that isn't allowed any longer, at least to the extent it's caught. And so when I look at this and I see the 1949 date, you enjoy the presumption if you can get before 2000, but then ODOT has to show that it happened sometime after 1949. Is that the burden then that ODOT has? Seems like a pretty simple burden to meet with the overhead photographs and things like that.
Yes, Representative Bentz, that would be the sort of documentation that we could show, that we could use to determine at what point in time a particular driveway may have come in to existence, because we do have aerial documentation, roadside documentation over the years of what's been out there. So the burden is on ODOT to be able to show that it was not in existence prior to 1949 when the statute came to be, about requiring permits for use of the public right-of-way and access to the state highway. But it could also be something that the landowner themselves could contribute to by showing somehow a photograph or something that would indicate that they've had that property and, in fact, had a driveway to whatever road was out there since before 1949. So it's a shared opportunity, but clearly the burden of ODOT to show if we can show that it was built after 1949.
Right. So the question then, of course, is how many folks, how worried should people be about a sudden effort on ODOT's part to call into question the literally hundreds of access points along the state highway I drive over every time to go back and forth to Ontario.
Right.
Should they be laying awake at night worrying, or is this something that hopefully won't come up?
Representative Benz, I would state that they should not, and that much of the goal around this was to provide some certainty to landowners so that they could that they would have to worry less. If it's a driveway that's been in operation for any period of time, hasn't created a safety problem or operational problem, the question of whether or not it's permitted becomes less of an issue with this legislative language by allowing us to manage it as if it is permitted. And it's only if we're experiencing a safety problem at a particular location that we would want to engage the landowner in how to alleviate a safety or operational issue. And we've got plenty of process around the landowner's rights and opportunities if that became the case. But the concept here, the overarching goal was to alleviate that concern by including all of those driveways that don't have permits or are not clear on how they came to be or when they came to be, alleviate the anxiety of landowners from thinking that ODOT could come in any time and close them by limiting where we would implement or apply a closure decision to only those locations where we know we've got a safety issue or operational problem.
And Representative, I'd like to add, this was a large discussion. There was a lot of discussion about the issue that you're talking about right now. And not only from like Commissioner Polk from, or we keep calling Polk, Commissioner Pope from Polk County, and also Mark Whitlow, who's a land use attorney and was very, very advocated very well for the landowners with this particular issue. So there, that was a quite a lengthy discussion with all the stakeholders as to, you know, who has to prove that this driveway was there in 1932. And so there was a lot of discussion with that, and from that came this, you know, it's the burden, it's ODOT's burden to prove, not the landowner. Mm.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? You've seen none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have Mark Whitlow and Lynn Goodwin.
Excuse me, here's Mr. Whitlow. Speaking of here.
Who'd like to go first? Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Whitlow, I'm a land use attorney with Perkins Coie, but I'm here on behalf of the Retail Task Force and the International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSC. Both of those organizations have participated in the stakeholder committee work that's been done on this legislation over the last few years, actually, as you've seen the work come before you previously in 2010 and 2011. So we're pleased that we're finishing up here with the triage. I think we have continued to search for the better balance between the property interests of abutting properties to access the highway and for the interests of the state in the highway so that it has good mobility. So we all sort of want everything. We want a highway that functions correctly, and we want to have businesses that operate successfully along the highway, and that's where we've toyed with the language of the better balance. And so I'd like to also thank Senator Johnson for her leadership on all of this legislation, and for particularly Director Garrett for bringing his organization to the table with us in a very productive manner. As others have testified, I mean, some of the discussion became poignant at one point or the other, but that's what makes a good product, we think. Everyone was invested with their own perspectives. We had a balance of biases, I think, is another way to look at it. But, you know, as we did the work, we tried to, all this work has been really over the 3 years devoted more on the permitting side. But as we looked at the permitting dynamics and tried to make things more clear, certain, predictable, we also were cognizant of the fact that you know, the state has to pay money for closures from time to time. And so we tried to direct our work in a way that wouldn't increase the state's obligation to spend money. So I don't think that the bill before you affects you know, the condemnation side, if you would, of access management. But I know that you're going to hear from a witness who's concerned about that, and that's why I'm bringing this point up. I think it's neutral as to the event. There's a landmark case in Oregon that talks about what types of closures are compensable. It's a Court of Appeals case that came up in 1999. It's still good law, State v. Hansen. And so that's the leading authority, and it isn't hinged on whether there's a permit for the driveway. It's whether there's a contract with a reserved right of access. And so, again, I don't believe that this virtual permitting that we've come up with that is really, in my mind, simply a simple way to housekeep and to make up for the prior lack of permitting that was done. And that's all understandable. These projects are big and so forth, and the state has good information when they look at their construction plans and drawings. It just didn't result in a lot of permits being issued after the projects occurred. So this went on for years. But I think as we discussed the event, we found that, you know, it'd be hard to identify a lot of driveways that weren't in a segment of a highway that had been subject to a modernization project over those, you know, decades. So that most of the driveways would have been built by the highway department or allowed to remain in projects that were built around them. So, and the other thing we took a lot of solace with respect to was the thought that under the statute, ODOT has always had the right to close a driveway that didn't have permission of the department or which was unsafe or both. And so that hasn't changed at all. This doesn't do anything to that. So those are my comments. I'd be available to answer your questions.
Thank you. I think we'll wait for our next witness and then questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bentz, members of the committee. My name is Len Goodwin. I'm the Director of Development and Public Works for the City of Springfield. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today, even though, as the previous witnesses advised me, I have the dubious distinction, perhaps, of being the only witness to testify against an access management bill of any of the three you've passed. I'm not going to go in detail through my written testimony. You've read it probably much better than I can deliver it. But let me say basically that from the perspective of the City of Springfield, we are very supportive of the efforts that ODOT and the task force have made with respect to access management. Both 1024 and 264 are excellent models of how to improve the management of access to state highways. And I believe we and many other cities have benefited from them. Much the same is true with respect to 408A, with the exception of the issue we're talking here about unpermitted accesses. You might wonder, why is a representative from a city coming here to talk to you about unpermitted accesses to ODOT highways? Well, in my written testimony, there's a map. It's a map prepared by our colleagues at ODOT with respect to Main Street in Springfield. It only covers a portion of Main Street, that portion from 20th to 71st. There's a long portion of Main Street beyond that, a couplet actually, that goes into the heart of downtown. But in that area, there are 936 accesses. I couldn't count, actually, all of the blue, red, and yellow dots on the map. Even at the scale I printed it, they were often hidden. But our estimate is that probably about 800 of those are unpermitted accesses. The balance are permitted in some form. Why is that relevant to the city of Springfield? Well, ultimately, in the course of the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, that Main Street, which is now State Highway 126B, will become Main Street of the city of Springfield. Like most other cities in Oregon, with, I guess, the possible exception of Portland, Main Street is often a state highway. It's often a state highway because it was built before or at the time the community was settled. So when that street becomes a city street, not a state highway, assuming this bill passes in its current form, the city of Springfield will have 936 permitted accesses that it will have to manage through its own local access management policies. I don't dispute Mr. Whitlow with the state of the law with respect to condemnation, but I will say that having experienced negotiations between the property owners who are represented by very able counsel like Mr. Whitlow and our parties, we often find ourselves in a position where a city council will avoid at great cost taking private property through uses of eminent domain proceedings or quiet title proceedings or whatever, much more likely to negotiate some sort of agreement which does, in fact, compensate owners for the reduction in their access, even if technically, as a matter of law, we could have stood on our rights and perhaps insisted and hopefully been successful. But, of course, that Main Street is in the future, and I would actually like to spend the last couple of minutes of my testimony talking about something that's much more real in the city of Springfield. Between Springfield and Eugene, there's a section known as Glenwood. It's something that is probably very familiar to most members of the committee. It is a section that is probably one of the last pieces of undeveloped frontage along the Willamette River between Portland and somewhere in California. In 1999, that area came under the planning jurisdiction of the city of Springfield after having been under the jurisdiction of the city of Eugene. For a number of years, we've studied Glenwood. We have come to the conclusion that it is a diamond that is about to be developed properly as perhaps one of the most advanced urban environments in the state. We are at present designing a multi-way boulevard, which will have four through lanes of traffic to promote mobility, which will have access roads to promote access to the frontages along the street, which will have mass transit. There is already an existing bus rapid transit line there, and our concept design is one which would allow for exclusive lanes for rapid transit at such time as it becomes developed. We expect that it will have four roundabouts. Now, I understand there will probably be some people who will jump in fear at the thought of four roundabouts. But in fact, we have discovered, and we have been working with the Truckers Association, and they have concluded as well, that mobility is actually improved by those roundabouts because they don't have to stop at a stoplight. And stop time is fuel time is money to a truck. Why is that relevant? Well, one of the reasons it's relevant is that there are 64 accesses in Glenwood. 8 of them are streets, 56 of them are driveways. I can't tell you how many of them are permitted and how many of them are not permitted.
What I can tell you is if you look at the concept design for Franklin Boulevard, virtually none of those accesses will exist in the future. As I mentioned, we will have four through lanes, and we will have access lanes that go off the side of those lanes to access the properties. The concept design for that area is mixed-use residential, with commercial activities on the ground floor, teaser parking along the street for the to attract businesses or attract customers and give them some place to park, and residential buildings above and behind them. There will undoubtedly be structured parking available for the residents in the facility and also for the commercial activities. We are talking about minimum residential densities of 50 per acre, 50 to 100 dwelling units per acre. That sort of design, which is probably very much in keeping with the modern multimodal approach that ODOT is encouraging every locality to consider, will be utterly inconsistent with accesses at every property line along the street. Any business owner can tell you that a commercial strip along a block that is broken up by driveways every 50 feet is probably not going to do well. We will be closing a large number of accesses. Will we have to pay for them? I can't guarantee that we will, because, of course, I don't even know how many of them are deeded or how many are permitted or how many are simply unpermitted and would become permitted under this legislation. But I can tell you that our experience with trying to close accesses is one that lends itself toward the fact that the local government will end up paying money to get that access closed, whether or not legally they may insist upon it. I
apologize for missing the beginning of your testimony. I'm not I didn't catch all of it, but I'm wondering if you're nearing the end so we can get some questions in for you and your
yes
your
I've got about 5 seconds, I hope. Thank you, Chair Reed. There's one example in my written testimony that illustrates the point I'm talking about. A facility on our Main Street had one access on a side street, three accesses on Main Street, a frontage of 165 feet. Main Street is notorious for pedestrian deaths. ODOT has designed a series of safety projects to go in along Main Street. One of them was to be in the immediate vicinity of that property. It worked best if we could close one of their accesses. We could not. We could have resorted to legal remedies, but again, that's not a way local governments, at least not the city of Springfield, proceeds. And as a result, we ended up with a less well-designed, less effective, more expensive pedestrian safety package than we could have. And we're having the same trouble with the other seven. That is why we are concerned not about sections 4 and 5 of the bill, but the permitted status of these accesses, which no longer have, never did have permits. With that, I am perfectly willing to take as many questions as I can.
Thank you for concluding. We appreciate it. Other questions? Representative Benz?
I was afraid to start, Mr. Chair.
No problem.
So I just do have one, and it's of Mark, and I appreciate the work on this and previous discussions about the challenges this presents. And on your letter, on the back part, you're mentioning the interests of the property owners and now the new opportunity to sit down and talk and be involved. What does that mean, really? I noticed in the bill there's a reference to through collaborative discussion and agreement. I'm not sure if it applies to these situations or not, but what does that mean, collaborative discussion and agreement? And I ask again for purposes of the record so that when someone says, if we don't reach agreement, you can't go forward, is that what that means?
Representative Vance, Chair Reed, it's a simple question and a long answer, perhaps. I'm going to ask you to repeat the question if you could.
I'm looking at actually page 2 of the bill. appears in line 33 where it says location of county roads, city streets within the area described in the facility must be determined through collaborative discussion and agreement between the department and the affected cities and counties. And I dredge that piece out of this product because it kind of squares with your reference on the second page of your letter to the fact that people get to sit down and participate in these exercises. But what ends up happening is we end up seeing situations just like this, and people start butting heads, and the question is, who wins? And so I understand why City of Springfield is going to the reality of a property right, but I don't want to go there. I just want you to share with us who wins these discussions, these collaborative exercises.
Again, this is a little esoteric, but the collaborative discussion is already in the rule for access management, and it's part of the internal appeal process that a property owner can take with ODOT in the permitting arena. So if there's an application made and it's denied, then an appeal can be taken. Again, inside the ODOT process, it's characterized as a collaborative discussion because it is intended to be an opportunity to sit down and still work together as opposed to going apart in an adversarial way. So it is not litigation. It is internal to the department by way of administrative procedure. And it really, in a judicial way, doesn't go anywhere. It's sort of a contained discussion at the department level. Except that you can invoke the new dispute review board upgrade to the collaborative discussion, if you would. It's part of what we've tried to do to invoke, again, a partnering. So we use the words and their connotations with, you know, the idea that it is still trying to work together and creating an atmosphere of working together. It really doesn't have anything to do with the City of Springfield's worries about compensation, litigation, or the like. It's in the perhaps when it comes into the new planning arena, where we talk about what a property owner could have for future access, then we developed two contexts: the long-range planning for interchange area management plans, where you had the ability to participate as a landowner in one way, or when the state is doing a project, a more focused discussion around the access management strategy the department would come up with, which would identify the driveways that would be closed versus the ones that would remain open. Historically, the property owner was not even notified that the discussion was occurring, was not invited to sit at the table and be part of the discussion or develop the strategy. So what we've done in the project delivery side, which is the piece that you're focused on now, is to let the property owner come in, get a notice, be part of the part of the discussion, and then be able to take that discussion up in the collaborative way, again, inside ODOT. It doesn't spill out into a court of law. And if we're unsuccessful in convincing the higher-ups in the community or in ODOT's management that the strategy ought to be something else, it really doesn't let the property owner do anything directly as a result of that. You just take a chance to have a better conversation, or at least to have a conversation that you never had a chance to have, and be positive and optimistic with respect to the partnering, and to think that, you know, people will listen to your legitimate interests in having the need for future access to your land. So, again, a very long-winded answer to your short question.
Go ahead, Paul. Thank you. Well, the short answer is ODOT wins. And after lots of discussion, and hopefully less litigation, because ODOT will, I'm sure, try to work with the landowners through this collaborative process. I mean, because because there is a slant in this document toward the economy and other issues that are something different than safety. And this is the same conversation that we had, I want to say 5 years ago, 2 years ago, and today. And so I'm not suggesting that the landowner should control the road. That's not the case, but indeed they have to work together. So I'm fine with the answer.
Thank you.
Other questions? See, my guess is that we're going to return to this this topic again before we're finished, but the good news is that this is a Senate bill. We have some time, so we appreciate you introducing us to the concept and the questions surrounding it. Unless there's anyone else who wants to be heard on the bill, you are the last who has signed up on it. Am I right? Oh, yeah, over here. That's right. Yep, so no one else has signed up. Anyone else want to be heard on Senate Bill 408 before we finish today? Everyone's rushing forward. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 408. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And that completes the agenda for today, does it? Given that we had a long floor session today and we have a still relatively modest roster of Senate bills in our possession, I hope we're going to get some more. The Senate needs to be a little bit more productive, but we're going to give you all the day off on Friday and meet again on Monday. I have yet to hear from too many of you as to things you'd like to cover in informational meetings, so please remember that that invitation is open. Any other comments for the good of the order? See any? So we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
I'd rather be here.